Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my very favorite guest ever, or all time, Tom Philpott, is joining me today. Tom is now working at the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins University, which he joined in 2022 as a senior research associate after nearly 30 years in journalism, most recently as the former food and agricultural respondent for Mother Jones. That was 2011 to 2022. And that's when Tom and I got to know each other, although I was watching your byline even before that, when you were with Grist, which became the first national publication to assign a regular staffer to the food policy beat, and when it hired Tom. The most important thing to think about right now with regards to Tom is his 2020 book, Perilous Bounty. Has it really been 3 years already? His 2020 book, Perilous Bounty, was named as an editor's pick by the New York Times Book Review and shortlisted for a New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism. It also came out in paperback in June of 2022. So if you didn't get the hardcover, you can get the soft cover now, and Tom would say thank you very much. Perilous Bounty has received in-depth reviews in the New York Times Book Review and the New York Review of Books. And the reason we're talking today with Tom, not only because I always enjoy talking with Tom, but because in a chapter of his book, Perilous Bounty, he described what appeared to be an unimaginable scenario. I want you to take us back to sort of like the genesis of that chapter two, as I recall. And you described the great flood in California's Central Valley of 1862. Tell us about that event and then place it in the context of current events.
Right. Okay. Well, so in 1861, California is a pretty new state, and it's been a state for a few years. The gold rush has raged and brought in lots and lots of settlers. The state's recently been transferred over from Mexican sort of control. Now it's part of the United States. And there is this, as there really has been since the very beginning up till today, this sort of, boom mentality in California. Mm. And so 1861, the gold rush is starting to wear off. People are, peak gold has been reached. There's just more miners than there is gold. People are trying to figure out, U.S. settlers are trying to figure out what to do next. Native Americans are living in this what's now the Central Valley. There's some, sparse cattle ranching by these Mexican rancheros who had owned the land under sort of a deed from the King of Spain, and they're now American citizens. And you've got U.S. settlers eyeing that land and thinking, if we could take that over, we could grow food for these budding metropolises of San Francisco Bay Area, Sacramento, and wouldn't that be great? Well, just that very winter, 1861, this storm starts in California in December, and it just rains continuously for about a month and a half. And we now know that these would be what we call atmospheric rivers, which are these storms that developed deep in the South Pacific, where it's really warm in the South Pacific Ocean. You got a lot of evaporation. The water comes up into the atmosphere and basically shoots in these vast river-like streams, high above the earth, to California, where they get hit by this, where they hit the Sierra Nevada mountains and fall as snow. And that sort of what California's winters are all about. Well, you had this gargantuan series of atmospheric rivers that year that you're just coming nonstop. And so this, you know, amazing amounts of rain and snowpack builds up, and then rain hits this snowpack. And what you get by 1862, early in the winter, is this incredible flood. The entire Central Valley. So anyone who's been, you know, driven, not the coastal route, but the sort of interior route from LA to San Francisco or back, has been through the Central Valley. It's this vast region that is, you know, more than 400 miles long and 50 to 60 miles wide.
Wow.
The entire thing comes under something like 20 feet of water. And it's this cataclysm.
Unbelievable. 20 feet of water from 400 miles north to south and whatever. Okay, apocalyptic, in other words.
Apocalyptic. And, you know, Sacramento, which is the capital of this, you know, fledgling state, it's on the edge of the Central Valley. It goes underwater. There's a change in governorship. And I believe it's Mr. Leland Stanford, who is a very famous and important figure in a lot of ways, is elected governor. And he literally goes to his inauguration on a canoe because the city of Sacramento is so flooded. And so this happens. And, you know, one of the things about this sort of California spirit of the time is, you know, it's obviously a catastrophe. It obviously wipes out these cattle ranchers completely. All the cattle are, you know, basically die. You can't get them out of the valley.
Right.
You know, really interestingly, there's contemporary accounts suggesting that Native Americans could kind of see what was transpiring. And it wasn't like, oh, maybe it'll rain, it'll stop raining tomorrow and everything will be fine. They figured out, you know, based on sort of, you know, knowledge of the landscape, having, you know, lived there for generations and generations, historical memory, they realized it was time to get the hell out. And so Native American populations largely escaped this, this catastrophe. And, you know, besides Native American populations, it was fairly sparsely populated, although, you know, people did die in Sacramento. There's accounts of, like, houses floating. You know, there's dead cows everywhere. It's a real mess. And then, you know, it happened at the very end of a long drought in the Central Valley. And the year after, another drought started. So it, you know, eventually dries up. The Mexican cattle rancheros are ruined. They basically sell their land for pennies in the dollar to these white settlers. And the white settlers are, they can't reestablish cattle agriculture because there's just not enough resources or money to restock hundreds of thousands of cattle. And so what you get is the sort of dawn of the modern era of Central Valley farming. You get, you know, grain ranching going on. You get wheat ranching. And what starts there at that time is this this really epic fight by these white settlers to control the wild water resources of California. This sort of variable snowpack that brings this incredible water resource every year. But if... you know, if you don't do something with it, most of it runs into the ocean through the San Francisco Bay Delta, through all this network of rivers. The struggle to control that resource begins in earnest. And, you know, they also figure out that they have this massive store of groundwater, this sort of aquifer water underneath them that is built up over millennia of water moving through the area. And so you get, you know, sort of the birth of what becomes this behemoth of California agriculture
right.
in the 20th century, moving into the 21st century.
Right, right. Staggering. So since it has become an epicenter for the American and global food supply, plus there's huge amount of dairy. Okay, there's big crops there. There's big dairy there. There's big oil there. So what, Like right now, and before we go there, let's talk for a second about the Tulare Lake Basin. Because as part of the sort of management of the groundwater, didn't they more or less drain that lake and the wetlands and, you know,
they
sort
did.
Of, so what is that? How does that figure into the potential for catastrophic flooding in the present day?
One thing we should also note is that, so this thing happens, it's probably the biggest natural catastrophe in U.S. history. Mm. You know, on sort of U.S. territory
that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
Right?
And it completely vanishes from the historical imagination. Now that is changing, because of recent events. People are thinking about it, talking about it. But I when I was researching my book in the late 2010s, I talked to multiple, multi-generation Californians who, you know, are history buffs. They hadn't heard of it. Wow. I talked to water people who, you know, work at places like the Army Corps of Engineers and that sort of, governmental bodies that oversee California's water infrastructure. They were like, huh? You know, I don't really know about that.
Wow. That's alarming.
And so it vanishes from the the historical memory, and save for some very heroic figures that I talk about in my book who've kind of like unearthed it. But there has been this effort in the past probably 30 years by a group of researchers, and the one I talked to, the one who's sort of been the most public facing, is this amazing scholar named B. Lynn Ingram at Berkeley. She's a paleoclimatologist, and so she dug into the paleo record of the state by looking at stuff like sediment buildup in streams in areas around the California Bay Delta. I'm sorry, the San Francisco Bay Delta, and other places in the Central Valley. And what she found was, and confirmed by other scientists, this is now in the scientific record, that there have probably been 5 to 6 storms much bigger than the 1861-62 cataclysm in the past 1,000 years. And so if we do the math, we can say that these events happen every 100 to 200 years. And, you know, it happened in 1861. The Spanish, when they controlled the region, they experienced nothing like it. So the one that happened in 1861-62 was the big one since European contact with this continent. But the suggestion is they happen every 100 to 200 years. And so, you know, the last one happened about 150 years ago. So already you start to get a little clammy in the hands thinking about it, right?
Yes,
but
then that's a good way of putting it.
Then the climate scientists come in and they look at climate models for the sort of weather dynamics in the South Pacific with these atmospheric rivers that I talk about. And what they figure out is that if you add warming temperatures, a warmer ocean, hotter temperatures above the ocean in that region, what you get is that the climate change means that this frequency is actually greatly increased. And there's this other incredible scientist. He's at UCLA, and he has a few different positions. He's very much in demand, named Daniel Swain. And everyone should follow him on Twitter. He's at Weather West. And just an incredible researcher and communicator about this stuff. And what they find is that they've done multiple papers in the past 5 years, even since my book came out, that a event on the level of 1861-62 is more likely than not in the next 20 years because of this historical pattern supercharged by climate change. And so, you know, one of the things that I always think about is, we built this incredible infrastructure in California over the past century or so to capture this snowmelt and divert it to farms. And we built this agricultural behemoth in the area. 80% of that water goes to farms. I think it's more like 90 for for that particular watershed, which is the main lifeblood for water in the state, the Colorado River being the other one. Right. And so we've built this infrastructure up at a relatively calm period in history of the state, and where it's been, you know, we get occasional floods and wet events, and we get occasional droughts, but it's been fairly stable, and that is beginning to unravel before our eyes. You know, the other thing that the paleoclimate shows, in addition to these crazy rain events, is that you also get long periods of drought, literally mega droughts.
And which they've had, right.
And they are two sides of a coin, the way the weather dynamics work. It's just sort of how the region is. And the stability that we've been counting on for 150 years since the U.S. took it over is completely unraveling. Part of it is a reversion to the mean. This is a very chaotic area for weather. And part of it is supercharged by climate change. And so that's kind of where we are. And then enter 2022, 2023 winter.
Right. We have snowpack that totals, I read the statistic the other day, but I forgot it. It was 244 inches or something like that. Or I don't know what that translates to, what, like 12 feet of snow pack.
Let's just say that it's four times the usual amount at this time of year. And in the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley, it is by far the highest in recorded history.
No way.
Is what I heard from, that's what I heard from Daniel Swain.
I didn't know that. Whoa.
The southern and the central snow, the central California snowpack, which gets into other parts of the San Joaquin Valley, the central Sierra Nevada snowpack, is also probably record smashing as well. So there is, as we speak right now, there is an incredible amount of water in the form of snow locked up there waiting to come down.
And right now they're trying to predict how rapid the snow melt will be so that they can figure out basically how to keep this water from inundating the entire Tulare Lake Basin, right?
That's correct. And let's just pause for a second to talk about the Tulare Lake Basin. So most of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, when it melts, as it does every year, as the snow melts every year, it's diverted into rivers that ultimately go into this massive delta, this unimaginably huge delta. It's called the San Francisco Bay Delta. Mm-hmm. And it goes out to the sea. Now, a whole bunch of that water is diverted into agriculture, into canals and dams and canals and reservoirs for agriculture. But there is this safety valve that if that infrastructure can't handle it, it just gushes out to the sea. And so you have to get a really extreme event to get massive flooding in that case. The southern part of the region is called the Tulare Basin. And it was the home until the early part of the 20th century of the biggest lake in North America, west of the Mississippi River.
Wow.
Tulare Lake was this massive lake. Now it did fluctuate dramatically year to year and season to season because it is fed by the snowpack. So the southern snowpack has nowhere to go but this lake. Now these agricultural interests, these incredible sort of settler farmers in the early 20th century, they basically drained the lake and built dams for the water. And there is this incredible book co-authored by Mark A. Rax, who is really the great chronicler of this region, called The King of California. And it's about this about a certain Mr. Boswell, who was from a cotton farming family in Georgia, and all that implies in the early part of the 20th century.
Right.
And the Georgia cotton farmers had basically burned the soil, and they also were overtaken by boll weevils. And so Georgia cotton farming started to not be so great anymore. So Mr. Boswell moved his operation to the Tulare Lake Basin, where land was very cheap because it's so soggy. It was basically a lake. Right. And he was instrumental in sort of restructuring the ecosystem there and draining the lake and making this empire that still exists to this day of cotton. You know, the Boswell family has diversified into things like pistachios and almonds, but they still have a lot of cotton ground up there, or down there, I should say. And so that's where we are. We have this, the bottom third essentially of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which goes all the way along the Central Valley, that entire 400 miles or so. The bottom third of it drains into this area that has no outlet to the sea. And so that is a very terrifying situation. And so what happened this year was I was monitoring the situation because, I had written a whole, a whole chapter about the possibility of a flood. And I was getting a lot of questions from people about, is this the big one? Because we kept getting these atmospheric rivers.
Right.
And what it turned out was that it really wasn't the big one. The total amount of precipitation was very heavy, but it, was maybe, I think it probably ended up in the top 10 of the past 100 years, but it wasn't like extreme. It was, a pretty small fraction of 1861-62. So it's not this big one storm, but in that part of the valley, it kind of was the big one. It was this historical amount of snow and rain. And so you already had flooding this past spring, parts of the lake refilled. But the thing that is so nerve-wracking and terrifying is that we are, we're going to be in massive flood risk in that area for the next 2 months because this massive snowpack that's four times the normal, that's probably, no more than 5% melted as we speak, is just waiting there, and it's too much for the infrastructure to take. There's just not capacity in the canals and the dams and the reservoirs to soak it up. And so there is going to be flooding. There's flooding right now. I'm just reading a Guardian piece about there's satellite imagery of the lake bed refilling. It is a very, very nerve-wracking situation.
Right. We got to take a short break here for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott. Stay tuned for more information about the potential risks of flood in California.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So, Tom, the question that springs to my mind is, well, many questions, as you could tell from my outline. But with all of the types of industry, the row crops, the dairy, the oil, are these all, let's identify where they are. Are these all in that particularly risky area?
There's two areas to think about. Well, kind of sort of three areas to think about, but with the question that you're getting at, there's really two areas. There is the Tulare Lake Basin, which is essentially the whole last third, the whole bottom third of the Central Valley.
Right.
And then there's an old Tulare lake bed, which is a smaller region. It's about, you know, 500,000 acres or, you know, 400,000 to 500,000 acres.
Okay.
Which is a good amount of land.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the greater basin in Kern County, which is just a little bit south of the lake bed, there is incredible concentration of oil production. If anyone has ever driven out there, you see the oil derricks everywhere. You see them in farm fields. You see them, you know, there's a grim vista from the city of Bakersfield where you can just look at this sea, you know, this high point in Bakersfield. You can look down onto the land and just see this sea of oil derricks, and the air just looks dodgy because all sorts of air pollutants are being put into the air by this oil production. And, you know, researching my book, I found that, you know, if you looked at Kern County as a state, is something like fourth or fifth most oil producing state in the United States.
Wow.
Ahead of Louisiana, which made my jaw drop.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So all of that is pretty low-lying land that is prone to flooding right now. It's not in the old lake bed, but we've already seen flooding in the oil fields. And that would have disastrous. I mean, I think it's just like, it's so ugly to think about because, you know, what ultimately happens to that water is that, you know, it's, let's say you get a big flood in a oil-rich region. What happens to that water is, you know, a lot of it evaporates, but that just concentrates the toxins in it. And then the rest of it seeps down. And where does it go when it seeps? Well, it goes into the groundwater. It goes into the aquifer. And so that's pretty ugly to contemplate. And then you get, you know, I hope, I don't have any reporting on this, but I hope there is a big push to get agrochemicals out of, you know, onto higher ground, out of flood danger, because, you know, in an area that is, you know, essentially all under either oil or, you know, mostly agricultural production, there's a lot of fertilizers and pesticides sitting around waiting to be used.
Right.
You don't want to see that swamped. And then the Tulare Bay, and, you know, cotton, there's a lot of cotton still in the old lake bed. And cotton is a very chemical intensive crop. So there's definitely a lot of pesticides and fertilizers involved with cotton production. And then you get the whole question of cows. And so one of the things that stunned me, let me just say that this is an area very dense. Even the old lake bed has multiple giant dairy CAFOs, like, you know, massive.
Yeah, tens of thousands of cows in each facility. Yeah.
Massive operations. You go out of the lake bed, the whole area is just full of these industrial scale dairy farms. And so, you know, when I was, you know, researching the book, I was like, okay, what were the old, you know, Spanish, Mexican/Spanish cattle like? Well, they were mostly grown for cattle. They weren't very big. They were a lot smaller than the modern dairy cow, which is a giant animal bred to be really big, bred to be a machine that puts out milk. And so moving them out of harm's way has already been really tricky when we've had these sporadic spring floods. But if... Right. If the conditions are right and we get a really big flood, that's going to be a catastrophe. Then you think about their manure and their, you know, these giant manure pits that they have, and those just sort of getting washed into this water. One thing I should say is this, when these floods happen at a substantial scale, you got water standing around for months and months. And it is not fun to think about. And I think that there was a Tulare Lake bed flood in the 80s. And some of that water stuck around for a year.
Wow.
And it is not fun to think about sort of standing water with, you know, giant amounts of cow manure and, you
dead
know,
cows.
potentially dead, you know, massive dead, you know, cow carcasses,
effluent from oil rigs. I mean,
this oil that we're talking about, and right. You know, Katie, you asked in your, you know, in your outline, you were asking about like, what does that do to the soil? I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows. Some of this stuff will stick around in the soil. It's not a great situation. But what we do know is that it all ends up in the water, in the groundwater. And this is an area that already has incredibly polluted groundwater. There's already high levels of nitrate and pesticides in these aquifers. And there's a real environmental justice situation here because it's mostly farm worker communities that live in these areas, especially in the rural parts. And they already have this incredibly polluted water. There's already, you know, lots and lots of money, very low income people buying, you know, bottled water because the water is not safe to drink.
That's right.
And so we're looking at a real catastrophe on that level. Like, how are we going to filter that water? What is going to happen? And, you know, one thing else that I didn't get in my piece, but I was thinking about is just apart from these horrible problems that we're talking about now, about contamination of the groundwater, would this past winter, which was so wet, so much rain, so much snowpack coming down, would it refill the aquifers, which have been, you know, drained over the past 25 years, you know, in a dramatic way, just like they've been way overpumped. Will there at least be some recharge? And, you know, basically, you know, the answer is, you know, maybe enough to offset one drought year, but we've had, you know, eight drought years in the past 12 years or something like that.
Yes, that's right.
And so the amount of recharge is going to be, you know, was, I should say, because the season's basically over, fairly marginal. I mean, it was great and, you know, substantial. But at the scale of withdrawal, it's no game changer. All of California's drought problems, which are what we're usually talking about, and we've probably talked about on the show, are still there. And, you know, the place could go into drought next year, or it could have another cataclysmic winter next year. I mean, it's just very unpredictable. But yeah, so that's the basic situation. There's a lot of unknowns, but none of it looks good.
You know, let me ask you this. Are you aware of any kind of major state or federal preparation underway in anticipation of the worsening flooding, like evacuation? And then also, didn't we talk about the Oroville Dam, like almost failing a few years ago, and then somehow they managed to... Like, that would also be, that's like one of the key pieces of infrastructure that keeps the water where it's supposed to be instead of, you
know,
it's
one of the dams. Let me just say something else about this this situation in the San Joaquin Valley, which is, so, you know, basically the Central Valley, you get Sacramento Valley, which is the northern part, San Joaquin Valley, which is the middle, and Tulare Basin, which is the bottom. And the San Joaquin Valley also has this tremendous snowpack coming down.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the things that I interviewed Dr. Swain for my piece, this great UCLA scientist, and, you know, what he told me was that, you know, we know there is going to be flooding because if you do the math, there's just too much water up there to be handled by this infrastructure.
Uh-huh.
But is it going to be catastrophic flooding or minimal flooding? It's really all based on how fast the snow melts. And what you really pray for is a very slow, orderly snowpack. You pray for a cool spring and early summer in the Sierra Nevada foothills, Sierra Nevada range. But he said, you know, even under the best case scenario, of a very, you know, orderly snowpack. Like I said, there's still going to be, you're still going to get part of Tulare Lake refilling. It's just going to happen. But, you know, potentially non-catastrophic, but you've got all this water coming down And there is just so much chance for the infrastructure to fail under the pressure of all this water.
Right.
And so you could get infrastructure failure, the various flood control and sort of water control infrastructure that they have out there is aging. It's not very well kept, astonishingly. I think that's just mind-bending considering how big agriculture is there. And so you could get breakages, and you could get places even in the San Joaquin Valley that are, you know, where the water does flow out to the sea if it stays in the rivers. You could get this, you could get infrastructure failure, and you could get really bad flooding there too.
Yeah.
And so what you're praying for is something that hasn't happened very often recently, and that is a very cool spring. We've had very hot springs and summers in the Central Valley for a while now.
And so, aren't we expecting a massive heat wave? I know it was the Pacific Northwest, but still, I mean, I'm assuming that California will absorb some of that excessive heat.
It's certainly plausible, and it certainly could happen. But yeah, once again, the Pacific Northwest is about to be under, or maybe already is, moving into unusually hot temperatures, and those could get really bad. But yeah, that could easily happen in California. It would almost be surprising if it didn't.
Yeah. That's how I feel. I mean, I'm just waiting every day to hear some, you know, like as it gets warmer, to hear that some massive piece of infrastructure has failed and the, you know, level of water is just, you know, tripled and whatever reservoir, you know, all of that stuff.
So the other scenario is that you get a big early melt and it just overwhelms everything. And it's not infrastructure failure. It's just the infrastructure got overwhelmed. But to your question, yes. You know, the state water officials are in the region trying to figure out what to do. But I think they've got a bigger problem than can be handled. And yeah, there are farm worker communities in the old lake bed or on the edges of the old lake bed. But, you know, one of the things that that has happened is that there's been so much subsidence. And that is when you withdraw groundwater at an unsustainable pace, the land literally sinks.
Right.
And this is an uneven process. And so the old lake bed, because of so much subsidence in the area in the past 20 years from groundwater over extraction, it's kind of unpredictable. They're having a hard time figuring out where all the water is going to go because the landscape has changed. You usually don't think of landscape, you know, things like elevation changing in, you know, the amount of time it takes to, you know, get through high school, but
no, you don't.
You know, we think about it in a long, sort of long term, but like there's been significant subsidence in the past 10 years. Like we're talking about multiple feet of subsidence. And like I said, it's not like everything sinks at the same pace. It's changing the elevation and changing water directions, like where water would flow. And so that's something else that is flummoxing people. And so it's just a really grim situation that is going to require constant attention for the next 2 months.
And look at how prescient you were, Tom, in digging this up in your book 3 years ago and advertising that this was an impending, potentially cataclysmic event. Before we finish up here, which unfortunately we have to do in a couple of minutes, I just want to talk a little bit about what the impact for the rest of America will be when and if this region can no longer produce. Because as we just described, you know, if the water is as polluted as we anticipate, it spreads out over a lot of arable land. I don't think we're going to be growing crops in that land anytime soon. What is the consumer side of this look like, right? I mean, we talked about supply chain disruption during COVID, but I mean, this is going to be epic. Like, what are we looking at here?
Well, one of the things that I think about is that we've had this period for the last couple of years of inflation of food prices, and it's really kind of caused a lot of political upheaval. And it's kind of, you know, inspired, it's been part of the inflation that's inspired the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates to potentially trigger a recession. And we've seen food prices coming down recently. They're still pretty high, but they're, you know, we've seen it kind of coming down. And here we are heading into an election year, right?
Yeah.
Election's next year. And, you know, things are really volatile out there. And what we could see is, you know, if we get, you know, let me just talk about the immediate effect. If we get, you know, really catastrophic flooding in this area, it could cause the price of, you know, things like, let's say, milk. The milk market is pretty regional. So it could be, I mean, I think it would trickle throughout the country, but it could, you know, be a spike in milk prices on the West Coast, western part of the United States.
Sure.
And, you know, we heard a lot of, you know, real, I think, legitimate complaining about from families who live on a, you know, tight economic margin about suddenly a gallon of milk, you know, rising a couple bucks a gallon and what that does to family budgets. We could see that happen again. There are various fruits and vegetables that come out of that region, a lot of kind of stone fruit. What else? You know,
nuts.
There are some salad greens, you know, obviously nuts. Nuts are a thing that I see nuts as a bit of a luxury product.
Like I do too.
If I like almonds and the almond price spikes dramatically, I'm not too upset to turn to peanuts, let's say, or whatever,
which
can be, you know, are on a totally different ecology and economy. Spikes in nut prices don't worry me as much. I think they're, you know, I think it's kind of a frivolous, it's a good use of some of that land, but, you know, I'm famously on record saying that it's frivolous to devote quite so much land to it in that area, almonds, pistachios.
Right. Water suckers to the nth degree, right? I mean.
Yeah. But then, you know, and they're permanent, so they need a lot. They need water every year. So if you have a bad water year, you can't fallow your almonds because you're going to lose a huge investment. That's one of the problems with them. But now, longer term, you know, if this turns into a real I'm not going to swear on your radio program, but a real bleep show in that area and the soil, there's like, you know, significant soil degradation from chemicals. The groundwater is awful. The water's hanging around and causing problems. And, it, you know, it disrupts agriculture for a number of years. I mean, I think it just kind of goes back to the thesis of my book that it puts a lot of pressure. And this is something I was trying to sort of start a conversation about in my book. It puts a lot of pressure on other parts of the country to pick up the slack and grow the fruits and vegetables that we rely on California for, to grow them more in other parts of the country. And I think that, you know, I think you could see like a longer term food inflation that I think would inspire, I hope policymakers would step in and say, okay, we need to, you know, really invest in, you know, regional fruit and vegetable production. We need to figure out how to support farmers, how to, you know, create a food shed that can make up for this, you know, this shortfall from California. And I think that has to happen anyway. And this could be a real accelerant for it. But, you know, let's not sleep on the sort of destabilizing effect of food inflation going into an election with some, you know, true, you know, oddballs, you know, rising to the top as contenders from a certain party. that's the kind of thing that scares me right now. And, you know, the other thing is I just think about the people who live in the region who tend to be low income. They tend to be Latino farm workers, you know, many of them undocumented, the very people who feed us, and their lives. I mean, you know, the other thing is like the economic fallout from that. If you get, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres, millions of acres, however it turns out, flooding in the Central Valley, that's lost work for people who live on a very, very tight margin as it is, with a very porous, you know, safety net, oftentimes no safety net at all if they're undocumented. And then there's just sort of getting people out of harm's way during a flood. And you mentioned that event in Oroville, the Oroville Dam in 2017, I believe it was, when the Oroville Dam almost burst And the California, this is north of the region we're talking about, but it's in the Central Valley. And the water officials saw fit to issue an evacuation order for several hundred thousand people downstream. And it, you know, went about as you were predicting a thing like this. Everyone got in their car and tried to get the hell out of there. And the highway became a bloody parking lot.
Wow.
And luckily the dam didn't burst. All of that literally does keep me up at night. This is, I've written about a lot of, you know, terrifying stuff in my career. cover industrial food production, you end up doing that. And this is by far the most terrifying thing. It's worse than, it scares me more than superbugs from antibiotic resistant pathogens.
Really?
Just everything. This just terrifies me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on that, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye. Tom, people, again, the book is Perilous Bounty. Pick up a copy because there is so much great content in there. Not the least of it, but certainly one of many interesting chapters. And I love your point, Tom, that this will hopefully encourage, I mean, should the worst happen, it will accelerate the development of a more regional food system, which is something that we take very seriously here in the Northeast, for example. But I think other parts of the country are slower to embrace that idea. So, Tom, thank you so, so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And last week, too, with our aborted mission. But it's always a joy to talk to you. Please stay in touch. And thanks, as always, to my sponsors. And thank you for tuning into this program. We'll see you next time. That's all for now.
And thanks back to you, Katie.
You betcha.
What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.